Good afternoon and welcome to the 33rd briefing from Municipal Chief Executive Officers put on by the Lieutenant Governor, Karen Polito, on behalf of the Baker-Polito administration, working in partnership with all of the cities and towns of Massachusetts. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and the MMA is honored to be the platform through which the administration delivers updates and answers your questions on a regular basis every 2 weeks during this pandemic. Just a couple of logistical notes. As always, we will be taking questions in the chat function. You might want to wait until after the Lieutenant Governor and the team provide their updates before you ask questions, because then you won't ask questions that will have already been answered. And then we'll proceed through the chat function to take as many of the questions as possible. Of course, this session is being recorded and will be posted with a summary article on the MMA website soon after the conclusion of the briefing, later today, we hope, in which case then you can share this briefing with the local officials in your community. We have, as always, a great team from the administration covering the whole span of information. In this particular briefing, the Lieutenant Governor will kick it off and then turn it over for a federal funds update to the team. And then we have DPH available to answer questions as well regarding our process. And there's a lot to cover from vaccines, from reopening and finance. So we'll get right to it. Lieutenant Governor Polito, thank you so much for your leadership and for working so closely with local officials to navigate through this pandemic and bring us out on the other side, moving forward with momentum. So thank you very much and turn the program over to you.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and to your entire team for your partnership, not only convening this hour that we get together to share information with all of you, but also to receive information from you about how we can better collaborate, but all the work that you do between these meetings, hosting webinars and really getting into the details and making sure our local officials from one end of the state to the other are informed and up to date and have everything that they need at their fingertips to better serve the people of our Commonwealth. So right back at you, a thank you. Well, since we last talked, it is now officially spring, which is great. The clocks have changed, so our days are longer in the evenings, which is really good. And I wanted to highlight a major milestone that occurred since our last gathering on this call, and that's having 1 million people of our Commonwealth fully vaccinated. I want to just thank all of you for your efforts in getting us to this point. That's huge. And it's obviously a reflection of all of the work that you're doing all across our state and with a constrained supply of vaccine. So the other piece of that is we're at a 91% administration rate. So the doses that we have received from the federal government that we get out into the communities and into the avenues where people can make their appointments and get people vaccinated in this Commonwealth. So there have been bumps along the way, but we've tried to smooth some of those out so that we can be better at what we do, which has brought us to the being number one among the states that have a population size as ours, over 5 million people in terms of doses per capita and doses administered to the people of our Commonwealth compared to other states. So that's thanks to all of you and your hard work. Let me just start with an update, which is a review of some of the information that we have shared with you, but just to go through it to make sure everybody is up to speed. And then we'll turn it over to Heath, who's going to get into more details around the federal funds that are coming to our Commonwealth and that we want to make sure you have all the information around how to deploy those resources. And of course, we have Sean Cronin and Dr. Madoff and Jana Ferguson here with us as well to address questions that you have. So obviously the pre-registration system went live March 12th, which is now over 10 days ago. And that has proven to be a very effective way for people to register for vaccine appointments at our MassVac sites. And there is a transition that is being planned for our regional collaboratives also to transition to the pre-registration system. And we will have more details on that as we roll out that part of the process. As all of you know, there are multiple ways people can make their appointments. There are 170 public vaccination sites for people to secure appointments at, and using Vax Finder for those appointments is also another way for people to be able to get into the system when they are eligible. The 211 system continues, and that was obviously something we put in place after hearing from a lot of you about how to make this easier for people that find it difficult to navigate either the pre-registration system or Vax Finder to be able to secure appointments. We have also advanced the eligible categories. As you know, yesterday marked the day for 60 plus and certain workers to become eligible, and on April 5th, which is not too far from now, 55 plus and people with one medical condition. Then of course, April 19th, Patriots Day, all people are eligible to secure an appointment for a vaccine as of that date in the Commonwealth. Also to mark is about 80% of people 75 or older have been vaccinated here in the Commonwealth. And every county at a minimum has reached 67% of people over 75 within their counties fully vaccinated over 75. So thank you. These are our most vulnerable among us. And I talk to a lot of people as you do, and they certainly feel more at ease and more comfortable having received the vaccine. Other key things too, we receive funds from the federal government that we can deploy through our state sites, such as the MassVac sites and our regional collaboratives. CVS has 85 active sites throughout the Commonwealth where they deploy vaccines. And these sites are scattered throughout Massachusetts. CVS is receiving about 90,000 doses a week. And a lot of educators since March 3rd have secured appointments through the CVS program. 46% of appointments available through CVS since March 3rd have been secured by educators, which represents about 66,000 people. So just to give you context about where people are going. In addition to that, based upon our conversations, we were able to also have four specific days at our MassVac sites, March 27th, April 3rd, and then the weekend of the 10th and the 11th for educator-only vaccinations, which is also another opportunity for your school districts to use if it's convenient for your educators. And regional collaboratives are also booking appointments either through their 25% set aside for dates that work for that area of the Commonwealth. And of course, the public sites are available to everyone, including educators. So thank you for all of your work in getting our teachers access to these appointments and to the vaccine. We also want to thank you very much for your work on reaching the hardest to reach in our communities. And the federal government was able to release $27.4 million to the Commonwealth to address vaccine hesitancy and increase the acceptance rate among some of these populations. And of course, Jaina may speak to the disproportionately impacted communities, of which there are 20 in the specific targeted measures that are being deployed to help address those issues. Later today, there will be a briefing specifically between DPH and the local boards of health regarding the Homebound program. And in response to a recent survey that many of you have answered, detailing which option that you wanted to use to reach the Homebound, there will be more details explained to the local Board of Health on at this meeting later today. And we're happy to share the specific details with Jeff and the team to share with all of you. We just want to thank you so much. You know your communities best, and you know where these individuals are, and having a specific program to reach them is really important. So thank you for that. Because of the progress we've made relative to COVID, we have also advanced the reopening of more activity in our Commonwealth. Moving into step one of phase four yesterday was also felt really good for some of these larger venues to activate, you know, starting to see, you know, Fenway advertise opening day on April 1st is also gives people a feeling of comfort and a sense of normalcy returning to the Commonwealth. So that, as well as other activities within that step one of which you are familiar, are now open. The other piece of this was the gathering limits for event venues and in public settings, now moving to 100 people indoors and 150 people outdoors. And the limits at a private setting like your home continue to remain at 10 and 25 in and out. Dance floors are permitted at weddings and events only. So you've got something to monitor there for sure, but that also is exciting for families and individuals having festive occasions like that. And the travel order was updated to an advisory. So those are all really good steps that we've taken because of the data that we've been able to analyze relative to the presence of COVID in our Commonwealth, and because of the hard work of people all throughout Massachusetts making good choices to get us to this point. I also want to acknowledge relative to municipal voting, which is an activity that is underway in a lot of our communities. This is your time of year where you are at town meeting and processing budgets and also taking matters to your local voters is important and has to occur. And extending the voting by mail provision was something that the governor signed last week to June 30th to help with that participation at the local level. Very, very important. I've often I can't understand when you think about when and how people vote, the voting that has the biggest consequence, I think, to your day-to-day life is at the municipal level. That's where the decisions are made that impact every service that you receive from your town hall or city hall, and to participate in matters that affect you in that way is really important. So I was happy that we could make that adjustment. I do know that Sean Cronin and MMA have been also working on the virtual meetings that you have also been able to use in order to process, you know, planning board, zoning board, conservation commission work to keep literally the wheels of government moving at the local level is something that's being analyzed as well. So I just wanted to say again, thank you. We're going to turn it over to talk about funds and more funds reaching you so that you can continue to deliver the quality services that people rely on every day in our cities and towns. So with that, I'll turn it over to Heath, and then we'll open it up for questions. So we look forward to seeing the chat activate with some of your questions and comments. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Lieutenant Governor, and for everybody that is joining us this afternoon. Really happy to be back with MMA. Since we spoke last a couple of weeks ago, there has been quite a lot of activity on the federal funding front related to COVID response. And so I want to take a couple of minutes and summarize some of the highlights of the activity that has been going on in Washington. And I think it is fair to say that we're closer to the beginning of this exercise than the end. So I think it is fair to say that there are very many open questions that are still, that the federal government will still need to provide us some context around, some definitions, this sort of work. But with that, I'll sort of jump in and do a short brief on the American Rescue Plan Act, and especially focus on the direct funding, direct local aid allocations that were included in that legislation. And while, before I jump into that, I will say I'm looking out my window and I see the Comcast service technician literally out in front of the window. So hopefully his work doesn't impede on this work, but if I disappear abruptly, that's probably why. So ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, $1.9 trillion bill. There's an awful lot in it. There's additional funding for education, for testing, for tracing, contact tracing, for vaccines, for childcare, for rental assistance and mortgage assistance. There's an awful lot in the package. And as we go along, we'll provide more details about those, about the sort of various streams of funding that are flowing through or flowing into the Commonwealth through a variety of different paths. But wanted to talk in a little bit more detail about the Coronavirus Local Fiscal Recovery Fund, which is included in ARPA and steers a portion of $350 billion to the state and to cities and towns across the Commonwealth. The first thing I want to mention is that MMA has circulated, I think is on their website, a listing of preliminary allocations by city or town those numbers are based on estimating work, projection work that the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform did as part of the sort of the legislative development process. So those are the best estimates that are available at the moment in terms of what how much each community should expect to receive. But as is caveated in the MMA document, and should be kept sort of top of mind, it is important to remember that those numbers are preliminary. And they're preliminary for at least a handful of reasons that that folks should be aware of. One is that the allocations that were or the estimates are based on data from the U.S. Census Bureau from 2019. There's at least a chance that 2020 data may be available and so they would the law requires the U.S. Treasury that will be doing the allocations to use the most recent Treasury data available. So there's a chance that the population figures used to calculate some of the figures may change. The preliminary allocations, we can get more into the details of the funding formula, but the a component part of how the funds are allocated is based on the Community Development Block Grant formula. The U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform used the federal fiscal year 2020 numbers to base their projections on. The fiscal 2021 numbers are now available and probably will be used to generate the sort of the actual estimate. So there's at least a couple of moving pieces that may change those numbers. I wouldn't expect them to change materially. On the other hand, certainly as U.S. Treasury goes about building out these, sort of redoing the math to do the allocations, to the extent that there were mistakes or other errors that they catch, I think the preliminary numbers should be used as a sort of a scoping tool, as a planning tool, but we should keep in mind that they are in fact preliminary numbers, you know, as we go about our business. I know we have gotten a handful of questions for folks, you know, thinking about, well, you know, there's an override vote on the ballot. You know, what should we think about? Like, how should we think about the federal funds in that context? And I would be pretty cautious about sort of baking in assumptions into a community's planning process based on preliminary numbers. So I would be really cautious when thinking about that. With those sort of caveats top of mind, I want to talk for a second about eligible uses of the new funds that are going to be available through ARPA. So there are four eligible uses articulated in the legislation. I'll bounce through them pretty quickly just to give you sort of some context for what's out there in terms of parameters. And then as there are questions and so forth, we can kind of flesh them out in greater detail. The four eligible uses articulated in the legislation: response to the public health emergency or its negative economic consequences. That's a big one, probably the most flexible opportunity for uses of the funds. Point two, the ability to provide premium pay to designated eligible workers. So we can talk about that in a little bit more detail, but basically the chief executive of a city or town has the ability to designate people to receive premium pay. Point three, ability to use the portion of the funds for revenue replacement, calculated in comparison to your fiscal 2019 revenue numbers. There's much more sort of definitional work that we need from U.S. Treasury before we can provide more guidance about how the revenue replacement eligible use will play out in fact. And then point four, investments in water, sewer, or broadband infrastructure. So those are the four articulated eligible uses in the legislation. And again, I think the point of starting to talk about some of these parameters is to start to think about sort of scoping. What are the list of things we might be interested in doing as a community? So those are the four eligible uses. The covered period started March 3rd, 2021, and ends December 31st, 2024. So a relatively long period of time to spend the money, but not infinite. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that the legislation describes a process of sort of payment in, over the course of two tranches, with 50% of the allocations to cities and towns being paid out immediately, if you will, so, you know, within the next 90 days or so. And then the second tranche, the other 50% of the municipal allocation paid out not less than 12 months after receipt of the first tranche. So spread out over the, you know, 50% now and 50% a year from now. So those are the two tranches, covered period we talked about, eligible uses we talked about, and we talked a little bit about sort of some of the caveats around allocations. So I've clipped through a lot of stuff really quickly. And so happy to answer specific questions that folks have. I will say that we are very anxiously waiting for guidance from the U.S. Department of the Treasury, which is the federal administering agency. For context, last year after the CARES Act was signed into law, it took about a month for U.S. Treasury to issue program guidance. And so I think that that's sort of our expectation now is sometime within the next couple of weeks, we'll see initial program guidance and then be able to provide a lot more detail to people about the timing, you know, when this money is actually going to come to cities and towns, how much and greater specificity about what we can use the dollars for. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Jeff, I think. And I'm not sure who else is going, and then maybe we'll pivot into questions.
Thanks, Heath. Yeah, we have a great questions from a bunch of folks on both the public health side and on the finance side. And so maybe what we'll do is we'll take questions back from the beginning and go through and you'll be up a little bit later on because the questions really started to fly when you started to talk. So Lieutenant Governor, now we'll turn it over to you and your team as we go through the questions. I'll say the question, and then you could either answer it or give it to one of your teams, or you'll do more research and get back to us. How does that sound?
Sounds great. Great.
Excellent. So the first question is from the City of Newton. They understand that the contract for the Community Tracing Collaborative expires in June, and the city and many other communities depend heavily on the CTC to do contact tracing because there isn't the local bandwidth to take on all that full role. Do you know if the state is intending to renew or extend that contract or what the general timing is for contact tracing support to continue?
Well, certainly contact tracing and surveillance testing is really important as we roll in more activity in the Commonwealth and increase the immunization of the people here to COVID-19 and the federal funds that are available to support that. I don't know if Jaina has a particular answer to if and when the program will be extended for municipalities.
Sure, thank you so much. First, I think it's helpful to kind of just think about the contract. We extend the contracts in 3-month increments. And the reason why right now it's expiring in June, so to speak, is because it's the end of the fiscal year and at the end of the 3-month period, it isn't necessarily that the service itself will be terminated. So, you know, that's just when we have like a contract date. We're looking right now, I think, through September, but more importantly, we're working with the municipalities that regularly use the Community Tracing Collaborative to think about the services that are really important to maintain. So even if cases go down significantly, you know, what are the things that we can take from the investments that have been made around contact tracing to really help support the municipalities? So it may be also that there are certain pieces of it that are really meaningful, but the June date is really more about just the way the contracts are extended now as rather than any indication that that service will be closing.
Thanks very much. Great answer. It just shows there are so many different facets to all of the various elements of combating the pandemic. The next question actually is a finance one, and this is rescue plan funds have been allocated to counties in Massachusetts, and those counties provide minimal services at best. Is there a plan to reallocate those funds or pass them directly to cities and towns? Before I turn it over to your team, Lieutenant Governor, I want to give a plug for the work that you and your administration did working with our congressional delegation, the work that MMA did working with the National League of Cities, and that our colleagues in Connecticut and Rhode Island also did regarding this issue of counties, because New England, many of the states have either partially or fully abolished counties. In Massachusetts, 8 of our 14 counties have been abolished. And there was a real desire on the part of the Lieutenant Governor, the governor, and the congressional delegation, and all of you to keep those funds in the state. So there's a provision that says if the county is not a functional form of government, in other words, if it's been abolished, then those funds will, instead of going directly to the county, will go to the state, which will then redistribute them to the communities in the county on a per capita basis. That's the way the system works in 8 of the counties. But the other counties have a county government in place, and there is no provision in the federal law that would allow the state to actually divert or grab those funds. And what's unusual, because this is sort of a hybrid system, is we have some counties with very small governments and budgets getting a lot more money. One county, for example, is a $10 million budget, but they're getting $100 million to use, but the same uses is what's allowed at the local level and at the state level, as Heath outlined. So this is a critical area. It was not possible to get the language to make it sort of optional for states to grab the county money, because in the vast majority of states, those counties are large, full functioning operations that provide on the ground services. And it just, it wasn't possible to get that changed. So now the real process is for local officials to go to the counties and urge and ask that the county provide those funds to the communities, so the communities can put those funds to use the way the cities and towns and other counties that have been abolished are doing so. Heath, do you have anything to add in terms of the state's role in this? You would help to, of course, facilitate any decision by a county if they wanted to give the funds to you. You would then work to give those to the communities. I trust.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's a good answer, Jeff. I think the important things I would pull out that you all highlighted. One is that the money from the federal government will go directly to counties. That doesn't flow through the Commonwealth. We won't have an opportunity to divert or change that. Those funds are under the control of those six functional counties that remain in the Commonwealth.
What? 14, I did my math wrong. 14 minus 8 is 6, right? Yeah, sorry.
I think you're good. Yeah. You know, we have been in contact with all the community, with all of the counties, providing information, open lines of communication. And so they are, county officials are aware of the as Jeff said, sort of the hybrid approach here, where some communities will have one experience, and then other communities will have another experience. And so, I think certainly once there's more clarity from U.S. Treasury about, how funds are going to be allocated and amounts and the sort of thing, then I think we'll be able to work with those. Work with those communities, but I would say more to come on that front.
Well, in addition to being recipients of the funds from the federal government directly, they're also responsible for the full accounting of those funds, which is something we all pay a lot of attention to. I don't know, Sean, if you have anything more to add to that. You have been able to address some of the questions that have come from the counties over the course of this past year. Anything more to add?
No, just echo what Heath said. We're really waiting for the guidance from the feds on that issue and a couple of other issues, especially how do these monies need to be accounted for? I know I've been asked outside of this webinar multiple times, does this money have to be appropriated by town meeting or city council? Or is it spent like a grant? And that's something we don't quite have the answer to yet. Yeah, there are a few issues that we need some guidance from the feds before DLS can issue formal guidance, and obviously INF would be able to do the same.
Thank you. No lack of complexity here as well. So the next question, we're getting back to vaccine issues, and Lieutenant Governor, the question regards understanding that the vaccine supply is the constraint is still an issue. Is there any news to provide about the forecast and what may be happening from the federal government in terms of vaccine supply? And then also regarding the supply provided to regional collaboratives. And then later on, I know there's a question about the supply provided to municipalities that are caring for homebound residents and delivering those vaccinations. So just a question about the trajectory of vaccine supply and the vision for regional collaboratives. And also, I know there's a question later, Jana, about the number of vaccine collaboratives. So what's the plan as the number of vaccines increase to the state overall? Can you provide some insight on that?
Yeah, just on supply, we obviously all are very eager to see the supply of vaccinations increase a lot to the states. As you have all heard from the president and his administration, they anticipate increasing supply to the states because manufacturing of the vaccine is increasing until we receive the direct notice through the channels from the feds that our supply is increased. We can't make the adjustments in the programming that we oversee. But, you know, we're told at the end of March to anticipate more Moderna, Pfizer, and J&J. And that is what our hope is and what we anticipate will happen. And then we allocate that through the various avenues. I do have a sense that the way it's distributed, obviously we have our hospitals that receive a large supply. We're hearing a lot more from practitioners that they want to be able to administer a vaccine to their patients, which is something with an increased supply we can get to. Our mass vac sites are capped. I mean, we know what they are capable of doing, and they will level out at their capacity. And the opportunity for growth is clearly among the regional collaboratives, where these collaboratives, which are designed basically by you as municipals coming together to fill a geographic gap in our Commonwealth and to provide access regionally, locally to the vaccine, is where we will see growth as the supply increases from the federal government. And then, of course, you have the separate channels that the federal government supplies to CVS in the federal pharmacy program, some grocery stores also involved in that, and the CHCs. And I don't know if, Jana, you want to talk about the cadence of your review process for the regional collaboratives. I know four more were approved recently. And while they are approved, they're still waiting to receive an allocation. And that waiting game is hard because we can only act as quickly as we receive the supply. And the requests to form a regional collaborative and what the approval process is there for you, knowing that when it literally does start to rain vaccine on our Commonwealth, including the J&J vaccine, which is that one dose, we will be ready with increased capacity beyond the 7 mass vac sites and the 170 public locations across our Commonwealth.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, so we currently have 17 approved sites. That includes, these are regional collaborative sites. This does include 4 that are approved but not yet able to order. So we have 4 more who are ready, we're ready to bring online. We're working with them right now on some operational and logistical details, just getting their program ready to go. So when we are able to work with them to request vaccine and allocate vaccine to them to get started, they're ready to go. One of the big things that we're talking about, of course, with them is making sure that they are able to pre-register appointments for residents. The value, and I spoke about this a little bit earlier today to some, but the value of pre-registration, as you likely know, is this pre-registration portal will help identify vaccine appointments that are nearest to the person who has pre-registered. So while they're right now working through the mass vaccination sites, by bringing these regional collaborative sites online into this pre-registration system, will enable people to be able to access appointments closer to their home. So it's really important for us to bring these new sites into color, and then, which is the software that we're using, and then be able to start the new ones with that and then transition the other ones over. So there's a lot of work going on right now with both the existing sites and the new ones. In addition, we have received some proposals. This is a rolling approval process, where most of the other sites have, either active meetings planned. We're trying to figure out some of the additional things with them. I maybe don't have complete proposals, but submitted, but we're really actively working to try to solve those questions. But of course, we are prioritizing sites that are not really near other vaccine opportunities in order to make sure that, when we look across the map, that people who are you know, not near regional collaboration. And if there's a proposed one in that space, it's probably a, you know, an area we can help prioritize. And we've been able to also take a look at some of the vaccine rates that the Lieutenant Governor mentioned. You know, we're getting some great successes, but we're also able to see some areas where there may be some gaps. So, you know, we're trying to kind of solve for a few issues there. So we're in the process and hoping that the vaccine will become more available soon so we can at least bring these four new ones into ordering vaccine and vaccinating residents as soon as possible. Also, the, you know, that will continue to inform or into supply the vaccines available for senior housing, which we're still doing. And then also our homebound program.
And now, the homebound program is anticipated to be a direct line of supply for that specific purpose that sort of comes outside of the weekly allocation, so that the effort locally to establish, first of all, the inventory of people that fall into this category, then put your request in, and then be able to receive enough vaccine for that specific targeted program. And I believe, Jaina, on the regional collaboratives, you also are taking into consideration the population density of an area.
We are, yes.
So that access is a key part of how you determine what needs to be set up in terms of additional sites, venues, capacity to reach people.
That's correct, yes.
And just a couple follow-up questions based on the questions that were in the chat. Do you have a sense of the timing? I know that you Jana, said that you were going to be doing a briefing with the local boards of health on the homebound program today or this week. Do you have a sense just overall in terms of the timing of when you those vaccines might be getting out to communities that are working on the homebound program?
Sure. So actually we've been working on homebound for a few weeks now. We have surveyed all of the municipalities to determine whether or not they wanted to do homebound or in-home vaccinations locally, or whether or not they wanted to use a state vendor that has been set up to do this work for communities that choose that option. And also it's just to make sure that, you know, we were able to vaccinate all of our homebound residents in Massachusetts. So we started this in February, early February, started collecting information, pulling together kind of a plan and a resource guide. There are some complexities, as you might imagine, around transporting vaccine and the logistics of getting from different homes. So the health departments have finished identifying which option that they want to take. We have 166 communities have chosen to manage their own in-home vaccination program. That accounts for about 40% of the residents of the Commonwealth. And then the remaining 185 health departments have opted for option two, which is the state program. And that accounts for approximately 60% of the residents of the Commonwealth. So it's just a little bit more on using the state plan, but you know, not dramatically different. So what we'll do is we're collecting information around the specific details for those who are working on their in-home vaccine plan. We need a better understanding of exactly, you know, how many in-home residents. There's a screening tool they can go through. There are some available plans for like in-home caregivers who may also be eligible to be vaccinated at this time. So we're going through a process. We're posting the information about which community is doing in-home vaccination and which community is using the state program on our website, so that a homebound individual can look this information up themselves. There's an 800 number, a central intake number, where a person will be able to call to get into screening for the state program, but also a warm handoff if there is a community that's doing this themselves. We want, instead of just telling them that, you know, to call town A, we'll actually do a warm handoff. We'll call with them and help that resident get connected to the right individuals And we have plans for, you know, leaving messengers or after hours, that kind of thing too. So we're making sure that those residents, you know, have a really good customer service experience and making sure that they can get enrolled. So we have a uniform screening tool. What I'm going to be going through this afternoon with the local health departments is just kind of final touches around this, because we are getting ready to launch. So give them the 800 number, make sure that they have the resource guide. We have talking points for them to share with their municipal officials. We'll be sharing these also more largely with people who are on this call, councils on aging, a number of different stakeholders. So these are all going to go out later today. So there'll be a lot of information around this, and people will be able to certainly ask questions. There'll be contact information on this as well. So it really is a thoughtful program. We really want to do make sure that the residents of Massachusetts are properly served.
Thank you, Jana. That making it seamless is a big challenge, and we really appreciate the work that you're doing, because communities are choosing different models, and that always makes it harder to coordinate, but more effective, I think. A final question from the sort of the vaccine and the regional sites, and I'll just say that MMA is hearing from our members on both sides of this question. This has to do with set asides in regional collaboratives, because we have many communities that don't belong in regional collaboratives and are concerned about a set aside that that is being used just in for those communities that are staffing and supporting. And then you have communities that are in those areas that are interested in potentially even higher numbers and 25% set aside for use within those communities. Can you sort of explain a little bit of where that is right now, recognizing that communities in Massachusetts will have different perspectives on the balance that you're trying to strike?
Sure. So really based on some advocacy and understanding of what is happening locally with, you know, managing some of these clinics, the collaborations, and when I say collaborations, I mean the collaborating communities. So if it's a county that's really part of it, the collaboration areas countywide, some of them are collaborations are made up of like 10 to 15 municipalities working together. So there's currently an allowance to take up to 25% of the vaccine that might be that's allocated in a week to do some local work, perhaps to finish vaccinating people over the age of 75. Perhaps they're even working on homebound vaccinations in some cases. In some cases, they have done some educator days. But these are, and in some cases, they're doing equity work within those municipalities. So they're really able to choose how that vaccine is utilized, but it must serve the entire collaborative area. So it's not one municipality that does this. There is a range of feelings about this. Some municipalities don't, would like to be able to access more, or some of the collaborations would like to be able to access more at this time. Some communities, as you stated, Jeff, are upset that there is this set aside for the regional work. So it is a balance, and we're mindful of that. I think right now, given the vaccine supply, it will stay at the 25%, but perhaps at some point when there's a lot more vaccine, we can serve a lot more areas and bring more regional sites on board and some other providers on board, we can revisit that.
Thank you. Again, recognizing varying perspectives, all we think legitimate, just speaking to how challenging this process is. We're back to finance for a little bit. So Jana can take a sip of a Coke or something like that, or water. She's the health department. She's not going to be drinking sugar-based
water.
Heath and Sean, a couple more questions. I think you covered one having to do with the allowable uses, still very broad in those four categories. And looking for more guidance from Treasury, which we hope will come at least initially within a couple of weeks. Next question, though, is a great one as well, which is the preliminary numbers that that were shared for town and school by Brendan Sweeney, whose camera is off right now. Were those combined numbers, or evidently you've distributed, or some numbers were shared or maybe that was the link that Brendan put into the MMA's own story, but there's another bucket of money here. And that's the question. There's an ESSER III bucket of money that's separate from the ARPA direct aid to municipalities and the state and counties. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's a little different and it also has different timeline.
That's right. Yep. So the elementary and secondary school emergency relief grants, ESSER, there have been two rounds of ESSER grants to date. One last year as part of the CARES Act, that was $185 million that went out to local education agencies by formula, the Title I formula. And then ESSER II was included in the federal legislation that passed in December 2020. ESSER II is about $735 million to school districts, again, on the Title I formula. ESSER III was included in the ARPA that passed a couple of weeks ago, which is $1.6 billion to LEAs. That has a requirement that a portion of those dollars, 20%, are spent on learning loss related activities, either summer enrichment programs, expanded school day, this sort of thing. There'll be more guidance from DESE about what that means. But for obviously the bill just passed a couple of weeks ago, but to give you sort of a sense of scale, if you sort of 2X, double whatever your ESSER II amount was, that puts you sort of in the ballpark of what you should expect your ESSER III distribution to be, sort of more or less, and gives you some sense of scale. But those ESSER dollars, to Jeff's point, are outside of the direct local aid discussion that we were having earlier. So whatever your community's portion of that, so $1.6 billion is for ESSER that goes to the school district, is separate from this discussion about direct local aid to the city or town.
And that you would, the state would release those funds within, I think, 60 days after we receive them from the federal government, and they are available for spending through September 30th, 2023.
Good ones. Yes, very good. Very good.
That's excellent. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, on that. And that I'm going to jump over a question because this is a related question, then we'll get back up. But Mike Cahill from Beverly asked a question about other pots of money. There are many other funds that are available, and as communities are making, as you said, sort of scoping or planning for use of funds, it'd be very important to know the other programs that are being stood up so communities are augmenting or complementing those as opposed to standing up a program that already is going to exist through the state funding. Is there a chance to give a extremely high level view on what else is there?
Sure. As Jeff said, there's a lot of components in this in the ARPA legislation, but there are at least two areas that I know municipalities have expressed a keen interest in that I would highlight are the recipients of significant federal assistance in the bill. One is in the housing space, both in terms of rental assistance and in terms of homeowner assistance, mortgage assistance. The bill that passed in December included the creation of a new federal program, the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, ERAP, Emergency Rental Assistance Program. And then so that program has been in the program design and development phase over the last several weeks. The ARPA legislation provides additional resources to that program. So there'll be significant federal dollars available to support rental relief efforts. And I think it is, there'll be much more information available about that program, the ERAP program, over the next couple of weeks, the next few weeks as they roll that program out. In the housing and rental assistance and mortgage assistance space, there are significant dollars that will become available for those purposes. The other area that I would highlight is in the child care space. Obviously, child care services have been the focus of a lot of attention, rightly, over the course of the last year or so. There are at least two big tranches of money, both the another round of the Child Care Development Block Grant, and also a new Child Care Stabilization Grant, which would be sort of like a paycheck protection program for child care providers, so sort of direct assistance to child care providers. So in those two areas, that have been the subject of an awful lot of attention, there's going to be significant new federal dollars at work. But to sort of the broader point, it is really important to be thinking about policy areas in which which it makes sense to play sort of a supplemental role or a complementary role. And then there may well be some policy areas in which it makes sense in a certain community to defer to the federal program or whatever other resources are being deployed in that space. So we will, as part of the, once we're able to provide more concrete guidance to cities and towns about what's available, what's out there, I think we'll be able to provide much more sort of framework for how to think about approaching what is a significant amount of money, both for cities and towns, for school districts, and for other actors, in the policy space.
Thanks, Heath. This legislation is the largest bill providing funds coming to Massachusetts or any other state that I've seen in my three decades of doing this work. So a lot to manage and a lot to coordinate there. The question I'm going to hop back to is, we're hoping to reopen our town hall. Can you please confirm whether town hall employees who interact with the public directly are eligible to receive a vaccine in this grouping of essential workers in that definition? And we know that there's been work to try and clarify that language. So I'm not sure what the status is, but essentially the question is, we have people who work in town hall, in the permitting office or the clerk's office, or are out with the public directly, the same way retailers are in the retail space. What's the guidance and the clarity on that?
I was hoping to have more information for this call, but I don't. So we are reviewing that. We understand the request, and we will provide an answer to Jeff that will then be disseminated to the members.
Great. Thank you very much. It is one of those front burner issues for municipalities. Understanding, since there are a lot of people in the pool, people still have to set up their appointments and go through that process. So it's not immediate, but that clarification will be very helpful. Thank you very much. Let's see if we have any new topics. Heath, do you have any sense of when the specific distribution of ESSER funds will be available? You gave the ballpark of two times ESSER II.
That usually takes them sort of the 4 to 6 weeks to queue that up, make sure that they're, so they need guidance from the Federal Department of Education, and then they sort of build out the program. Should be very similar to the previous round, so it should be pretty straightforward. But DESE will queue it up with the feds, and then they'll disseminate information to the LEAs accordingly.
Great, thank you very much. And then there are some more questions about collaboratives. I'll just encourage Jana, if you could just take a look at the chat. I think I froze there. Jana, if you could just take a look at the chat, there are some questions specific to a couple of the collaboratives maybe and reach it back out to them. There's one in North Central Mass that's with a hospital. So how would they be getting their additional vaccines? I'm not sure if you're able to provide a question, an answer now.
Could I take one second? There are a few in the chat. I don't have specifics on any of the ones that are currently in the chat. So people should feel free to reach out to me directly. The door isn't closed on regional collaborative proposals. People are want to work with their communities are welcome to submit one. And feel free to reach out to me about these grouping of towns that are working with their hospital. You know, the one that about the 12 communities that can't get approved, I don't have that community on my radar. So it may be just a miscommunication about what may have been submitted, and people should feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to talk to people about their plans.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And we only have one question that is brand new. Oh, we have two. I'm sorry. And we'll close with these two. Heath, do you have any more detail on the CEO designating who can get premium pay, or is that going to be part of the forthcoming regulations?
Well, we'll certainly need more guidance from Treasury, but the law itself includes a definition of premium pay, which is up to $13 an hour per eligible worker, capped at $25,000 for a worker. And then the chief executive of a municipality is empowered to designate a worker as a eligible worker to receive premium pay. So that's, you know, that's sort of three sentences from the bill. But I have every expectation that U.S. Treasury will provide more guidance to us about what that means, the process that we need to go through to identify and designate a particular worker or classes of workers, and then how, you know, sort of how the mechanics of that should play out.
It's three sentences in a 600 page bill gives you a sense of how much Treasury has on its plate as it's writing the regulations and trying to answer questions. Lieutenant Governor, here's a final question to you, and then I'll give you a chance to offer some closing words. Would the administration support a further amendment to the open meeting law so that hybrid public meetings can be an option post-pandemic as communities figure out what the new normal is in engaging and working with their citizens?
Well, I understand that Sean Cronin and you, Jeff, and you have been working through this particular issue. Thank you for your leadership there. It's obviously under review, and we will have more for you there so that you have some flexibility and some options available to you. And in closing, I just wish to say thank you to everyone. I started off with the milestones that we've achieved together. We appreciate your hard work and efforts all through this year relative to COVID and the pandemic response. And at the same time, we're trying to balance budgets, continue to deliver services, and ramp up support for your businesses and your community. There's obviously a lot on your plates. And you're working with your school districts, seeing students have access to their education and helping families in that regard as well. I hope that when we are together next, that we are talking about an increased supply of vaccines. And that is literally the problem that we have to work through. That will be a good problem to have. So let's hope that we see that coming soon. And in the meantime, be safe, be healthy. And we are very grateful for your hard work and efforts.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. And thank you to your whole team for being here and taking the questions. As always, a recording of this briefing will be posted on the MMA website with a summary of our discussion and links to all of the specific links called out. Also, I just want to say thank you, Lieutenant Governor, to you and the governor for your partnership, but in particular to Sean and Heath and Jana, Larry, we weren't calling on you today, but in the background, for just all the work that you do and all of your teams in providing information, answers, and resources to local officials. This is not an easy task, and you do it very well. So thank you. And then to following up, Lieutenant Governor, on the comment about developing sort of the post-COVID like meetings and collaborating going forward, I want to say thank you to members of the MMA staff. Candace Pierce, who's our communications and membership director, also helped to spearhead a study with UMass, economists at UMass, who analyzed responses to a municipal survey operating in a hybrid mode with virtual and in-present meetings was something that a strong majority of residents or of local officials are interested in. There's lots of good information in this survey that the Candace and UMass worked to bring out, and we've posted it on the website. So please go there. And then in the background, as always, the man running the numbers is Timory Cook. And so thanks very much, Timory. So to everyone here, we say be safe, be healthy. We will see you again in 2 weeks. The Lieutenant Governor will be leading another briefing, and we appreciate that very much. Until then, take care.
Thank you, everyone.